Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We'll be hearing from Missouri's Education Commissioner, Margie Van Deven, talking about some of the problems facing public education in our area in just a few minutes. But first, a documentary photographer who spent some 3 years on a major project documenting the struggles of gays and lesbians in the military. The ban on gays ended some 3 years ago with a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a policy that kept them in the military closet. Vincent Ciani compiled and combined sensitive photos with dramatic and emotional interviews with his subjects who served before, during, and after Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The result is his book, Gays in the Military. Vincent Ciani is joining us now from NPR Studios in New York City. And Vince, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Don. It's great to be here with you.
Let me ask you about the genesis of this project. It was a long-time project, the second longest in your career, as I understand it. What got it started?
I was actually working in my studio in upstate New York, in Newburgh, New York, in November of 2009, and I was listening to the local public radio station. The mother of a 19-year-old Army private who had recently been discharged was being interviewed. And when she spoke about him in such a compelling, honest, loving, and also proud way, I felt moved as a gay person to be able to do something about the issue of gays and lesbians not being allowed to serve in the military. And as a documentary photographer, the best way that I could do that really was to begin this project and investigate their lives and their careers and the effects that the policy had on those lives and careers.
How did you go about finding the people that you ultimately interviewed and photographed?
Well, initially what I did was I contacted the mother of the Army private and asked her if I would be able to connect with him and speak with him once he got back from Iraq. He was serving in Iraq at the time. And in the meantime, that maybe was a 3 or 4 week process of getting discharged. In the meantime, I began reading books on the history of the ban on homosexuality in the military. And I began doing some searches on social networking sites, as well as contacting organizations that were fighting to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because it was at the height of the repeal movement. I began to call a list of names, start contacting people through various sources and various matters, talking with people. Many of the names, many of the initial names actually came from the books that I read, particularly Conduct Unbecoming and Nathaniel Frank's book as well. As I began slowly to build a list of people, I also started to become involved in the lobby days in Washington, D.C. with the organizations that I had contacted, and I started to meet people there as well. As I built up these list of names, I started to plan, and this began actually in the spring of 2010. I began to plan these 2 or 3 week road trips in various parts of the country, the East Coast, West Coast, Gulf Coast, and for the next 3 years or so, took these road trips and went through from state to state, city to city, probably traveling over 10,000 miles through 21 states, interviewing and photographing the subjects.
How receptive were your subjects to you? Were many or any apprehensive about what you were up to?
Well, obviously, those that were still serving in the military were apprehensive, and it took a very long time to build a sense of trust with those who were still serving because, of course, their career and their jobs were at risk if they were to be exposed. Some of the photographs that appear in the book show them obscuring their identity in some way or another. They're either facing away from the camera or they're obscured by darkness in the photograph. But when I entered into their homes, there was very little connection that I had with them. I entered their homes as a stranger, basically. And the trust really was built as I was interviewing them and listening to their stories. There was a sense of bonding that actually took place during the interviews.
I gather that the camera was very, very helpful in doing that somehow. Some people might be taken aback by the sudden presence of a camera, but it was helpful to you, wasn't it?
It was very, very helpful. Yes, and I think the interviews really kind of established that connection so that when the camera did come out and I began making photographs, I had an understanding of who they were. They had built a sense of trust in me being a steward of their emotions and also their stories. And that allowed me to really delve deeply into their soul, into the heart and soul of who they were, really.
Do you think that a straight person doing what you were doing might have gotten the same result?
I can't speak to that. I don't know. But what I do know is that an interesting thing that came out of it is there was a little bit more work that I had to do, me being a male, and working with the women that I photographed. I think there was a little bit more of a sense of trust and understanding and comfortableness that had to be established before I went into many of the homes. And interestingly enough, a lower percentage of women actually did agree to participate in the project than did men, as opposed in terms of how many I had contacted.
And ultimately, how many did you interview?
It was nearly 120 people that I interviewed.
Yeah. I must say and point out in the book, the sensitivity that we talked about a moment ago is very, very present in your photographs. They really say so much, as black and white photographs can so often do if they're done properly.
Well, thank you. One of the reasons why I do use black and white photography is to actually strip away all of the psychological underpinnings of color and to really kind of look into the soul of the subject.
The military is an especially tough place for gay servicemen and women, isn't it?
Back then it certainly was, and one of the things that came out of this investigation, because this investigation was really a look at the history of the ban on homosexuality. So the oldest person that I photographed was a 92-year-old World War II veteran, up to, as you had mentioned in the introduction, recent enlistees and people who actually were reenlisted or re-signed up for the military service after Donesto and Toa was repealed. And as we go through the decades, through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, you see marked differences in terms of the way that people were treated. So there was really, really harsh treatment of LGBT service members during the 60s and 70s particularly, which included physical violence, sexual violence. And during the 80s, when the military was downsizing a bit, they were a part of a group of people that included drug addicts, perpetrators, domestic violence perpetrators, that were actually weeded from the military through witch hunts. And then in the 90s, with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, even though that policy was thought to be a good, expansive policy to allow gay people to serve, because of the ambiguity, there were a lot of psychological effects that took place.
What about today? What is life like for the gay serviceman today and servicewoman?
Well, I think, again, I can't really speak to what their life is because I have not continued to investigate or interview and photograph them, but I do keep in touch with many of my subjects. And my understanding is that the ability to serve, and for those people who are comfortable enough to be out with themselves, because that's a whole different other issue as well. Even though the policy changed, the law changed, there's still many people who are LGBT who haven't really come out to family or friends and are still living under that secrecy. But I think for those who are able to live openly and able to serve openly, life has gotten much better for them in terms of job security, in terms of psychological security, and in terms of being able to carry on a relationship, build a life together with a partner, and be open about talking about that. Also, another aspect of that is the benefits that are that were given to non-LGBT members of the military are now being given to LGBT service members as well. But there's still a fight for the spouses of LGBT military members to get the same benefits as their heterosexual counterparts.
Did you ever serve in the military?
I did not. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that that actually I had to go through some inner questioning of myself. I grew up in the 1960s during the political and social upheavals and cultural upheavals, and I demonstrated against the Vietnam War. I was very much against the Vietnam War. I was, I guess, what you would call a hippie back then. And my relationship with the military was very tenuous at best. Even though I'm a gay person, and these are gay people that I photographed, our understanding, our political differences, our view of the world, the fact that we that they served and I did not serve, I chose not to serve, was not a major, was not a block, but it was something that actually I had to understand in terms of my openness and my willingness to embrace these differences, to be able to investigate their lives in a very compassionate human way.
When and how did you decide to come out?
I probably came out in my mid-20s. And that's been so long ago that I almost cannot remember. I think it seems like another life ago. But I don't think it was as difficult for me back then. I had this – I had – before I came out as a gay person, I had a very wonderful relationship with a young girl that I was dating in high school and college. And for me, that transition was just this kind of natural evolvement. And I think the actual coming out to family was a little bit harder, and that's one of the things that comes out in these interviews as well, is the religious backgrounds, the cultural backgrounds of people, the fact that homosexuality is not really embraced by many religions or many cultures. Or many families, in a sense. So that makes it even more difficult. Internally, it was easy. Externally, it was more difficult.
Well, times are changing. I think there's a momentum building in the country today for more acceptance, don't you think?
Vastly, vastly different. I think so many young LGBT people have amazing role models today, role models that they were never able to have back then. And I think the impetus of doing this project and doing this book, one of the impetuses of doing this project and book is to actually put forth these role models to say, hey, look, these people are just like everybody else. And interestingly enough, the way the book was designed and set up is that you don't really know who these people are until you get to the back of the book where the interviews are.
Yeah.
So there's this visual narrative that brings you into the photographs, the portraits of the service members, and then you go through pages and pages of looking at the portraits of people without them being identified. So you're able to understand their humanity without knowing who they are, what their experiences were. So you connect with them on a very, very human level. And then not until you get to the back of the book is their identity revealed. And in a sense, that's what happened with the whole issue.
Sure. Well, we're going to hear from some of them after we come back. I have to take a break. We're talking with Vincent Chiani about his book, Gays in the Military. And as I say, we'll hear from some of the people that he interviewed for this book, and we'll do that in just a moment. By the way, a special Gays in the Military exhibit of Vincent's photos will be shown at Webster University's May Gallery from February 27th through March 27th. We'll have more information on that on our website at stopublicradio.org. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Vincent Chiani about gays in the military. Vincent, I'd like to listen to a couple of clips from interviews you did with the people you featured in Gays in the Military. Can you set the first one up? I'm speaking of Katie Miller, who was a West Point cadet, and I found her story particularly compelling.
Katie Miller was attending West Point, and in the interview that I did of her and the conversation that I had with her, she tells about sitting in one of her classes, in a diversity class or an ethics class, and talking about the policy, the don't ask, don't tell policy. And while she was sitting in that class, her fellow cadets started to have this conversation that she says was quite primitive, very insulting in a way. And she wasn't able to say anything because of the fact that if she did, she would have compromised her her attendance there at West Point. She would have been kicked out, essentially.
These were her these are her friends she was listening
her
to.
Her friends, her cadets, these are people that she's bonding with, that you build this sense of trust. And I think that's what one of the problems of Don't Ask, Don't Tell was that you couldn't fully build a sense of connection and trust and community with the rest of the people in either your unit or your class or whatever the situation was because of this secrecy. And she decided before she had to fully accept the commission that she could not deal with this anymore, and she could not live in secrecy and live as a closeted gay person. So she did come out. And she actually came out on the Rachel Maddow show. She was very right. distinguished in the way she did it and just very honorable in every step of the way.
Let's hear what she was going through in her words. And this is Katie Miller.
There were three cadets that were very vocal in voicing their dissent against allowing gays to serve openly in the military. And it's not like they went about it in a very academic or professional manner, but they started throwing around these very vulgar and derogatory terms, making this a very primitive sort of conversation. And I just remember sitting there listening to them, and I really wanted to say something because I was just so angry. I was really offended. More than anything, I was very hurt because these were my friends that were very much insulting me. So I just sat there, and it was this very vulnerable state. And it made me rethink my entire decision to come to West Point. The fact that I was part of an institution that would allow me to be violated in that way. I knew that day that I was probably not going to be able to graduate the academy with the policy in place. The beginning of junior year rolled around where I had to commit to the military or I had to resign. I resigned, and I made my resignation public, and I told the academy the exact reasons why I was leaving. And I also made a deliberate effort to separate myself that week from my cadet friends for fear of, alienating them as being gay or lesbian. In that process, I was very much alone.
That's Katie Miller talking about her decision to leave West Point. That sense of betrayal, very, very obvious there, Vincent. I just found this an incredibly sad story. Of course, she went on to Yale, I guess, following her departure from West Point.
Yes, she did. She went to Yale to study law, and she actually became one of the most active members of the repeal movement that fought to turn back the law.
There was a heartbreaking postscript to that. We did not hear that in the clip we just heard. And that is some months after she departed West Point, she returned. Tell us the way she was greeted by some of her former compatriots there.
She returned to actually take part in a hockey game with her team from Yale. And she was she was actually not met with very open arms. A lot of people were driving by her and calling names out at her, telling her she was a traitor, or calling her these very inappropriate names again. So she wasn't welcomed at all back.
The another clip that I want to get to concerns a gentleman by the name of Mike Almy. And what struck me about this one was the fact that he apparently had sent emails to friends in which his sexual orientation was revealed, but the folks in the military were reading those things.
Right. Mike served in Iraq. He was a lieutenant, and he served honorably. He left his post and went back to Germany. And while he was in Germany, the person who took over his post was going through his private emails that were left on the computer, because when you're serving over in Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever the case may be, you are using military issued equipment to send personal emails. And yes, he was sending some personal emails to friends, and I think it was someone that he was dating at the time that revealed his sexuality. The person that found these emails had the option to either destroy them or not. He chose not to, and he chose to bring it to his command, which were then sent to his command in Germany. And he was called into the commander's office and asked to explain himself. And I think probably in the clip you'll hear a little bit about what happened with that.
Yeah, let's pick it up at that point from the time he walks into the commander's office.
My commander called me into his office. And the first thing he does is he reads me the DoD policy on homosexuality. And I'm sure I must have turned ghost white because I had no idea that any of this was occurring or had taken place. And then he hands me the stack of emails, and I look at them, and I recognize them as ones that I had written. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, how the heck did you get a hold of these? And then he asked me to explain the emails. I said, I'm not going to make a statement until I talk to a lawyer first. And so we went round and round for about 20 minutes, and he realized he wasn't going to get anything out of me. And so he relieved me of my duties right there on the spot and had a horrible disruption to the unit. And then a few months later, they suspended my security clearance, took away part of my pay, and then the whole thing drug on for about 16 months before I was finally thrown out of the military.
That's Mike Almy talking about his experience once his sexual orientation was revealed in the military. There's a certain brutality involved in the way these people were handled, don't you think, Vincent?
There certainly was a certain brutality that was involved. Mike actually speaks about leaving the military base and being treated like a common criminal. No one would talk to him. He was almost like a pariah. And that really affected him afterwards. He speaks later on in the interview of going through a few years of being depressed and actually being suicidal as well. I mean, it really whittles down a person's sense of value and sense of worth to be able to have to have been treated like this after serving so honorably.
Many of these people had distinguished themselves through their military service in various ways, but that counted for nothing once they were exposed.
Many, many people who were discharged. I think the number was over 14,000 people discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell alone, at the cost of billions of dollars of training, and just, you know, building up, educating the people, building them up so that they can serve in these very important positions. So yes, in a lot of ways, it was disruptive not only to the people's lives, but also to the unit and also to the military itself, and to, in terms of taxpayers' dollars, it was almost a ridiculous concept.
Did your interviews and your 3 years spending on this project, how did it affect you? How did it affect you personally?
I think I was able to learn to be even more open to differences, to understand that people's lives are very different than mine. Even though I am part, as I said, of this community as a gay man, that's only one aspect of who I am that connects me to that group. And I think what I learned just in looking at the world as a whole is being able to travel into people's lives. I use a quote from Mark Twain that says, travel is is travel destroys any sense of bigotry, prejudice, or discrimination. And really what he's talking about is entering into people's lives and understanding what their lives are about, what choices they made are based on, et cetera, what their life experiences are and what their political understanding is. I mean, once we begin to understand all of this about other people, we begin to understand what their lives are about, and we're able to embrace those differences and work together.
That really makes all the difference, doesn't it? Just getting to know people and recognize them as people, regardless of what differences there might be.
Right, and we don't really have to agree with them or, you know, agree with everything that they do or everything that they say, unless, of course, it's something that actually harms other individuals. And that's a very complicated, complex question. But I think one of the things that came out is that I did become friends with someone, Lieutenant Don Bramer, who actually held very extremely different political beliefs than mine. But because of this process of sitting down and talking with him and getting to know him and actually experiencing even beyond the interview and the photograph, because he's been very supportive of exhibitions and talks and panel discussions and that he's been on with me, I got to know him as a human being.
And he spoke, as I recall that interview, of really having to live, I think he said, three different lives during the time that he was in the service.
Right, because he was living secretly as a gay person, not only in the military but also in his personal life. He was living as a member of the military, but also his job in the military was to do secret covert operations when he was deployed. So there were these three identities that he had that were conflicting in terms of being able to separate them, being able to recognize and realize who you are at that given time and not divulge any information about each of those identities.
But what you've indicated, what an important job he was doing, you know, and to have that just suddenly squashed.
Right, exactly. Well, he actually ended up serving and still serving, actually. He was one of the few people that I interviewed that actually ended up being able to serve openly in the military.
There is another person that I would like to talk about, and that's Victor Fehrenbach. We have a clip of Victor. Very briefly, set this up, and then we'll go into more detail when we finish with it. But here is a guy who decided to fight the system.
Victor had been serving nearly 20 years. He went on multiple deployments. He was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. Flew over 88 combat missions, achieved an amazing record in terms of his service with the military. He was just about to go on another deployment, and he went back to the base in outside of Boise, Idaho, Mountain Home Air Base, for some rest and relaxation. He had been dating someone at the time. They broke up maybe about a week or so later. He had a fling with someone, a civilian, who actually ended up accusing him of rape, went to the Boise police and also the military base to actually accuse him of rape. And because of that, they brought him in for investigation.
Let's pick up the story there with Victor Fehrenbach.
At the time they were debating, they were trying to find out if I was the highest ranking, most decorated person discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which means I have the leadership role by default. So I have to lead and I had to protect those under me. And that's the way I saw it. To me, there was almost no choice. That day after the first interview, I drove to work that morning and I put my uniform on. I found myself walking up at the squadron with a pride I'd never felt before. I was about to walk in and never have to hide and never have to lie. So I remember walking and feeling myself being taller.
Feeling taller. But he was one of those, as I indicated, that decided to stand up against the system. Can you pick up the story from that point?
Sure. What had happened when he came under investigation, he started to question why the Boise police brought him on base to interview him, to interrogate him. And one of the reasons why is because this, he reveals that this has happened before with this person who falsely accused him of rape. He had done it before, but it was a way of actually revealing people's sexual orientation and getting them discharged. And he decided that he would fight his investigation and also fight his discharge. And it took him a very long process to be able to do that because, again, he was not out to his family. He had contacted Service Members Legal Defense Fund, which was the primary organization that was working with a lot of discharged members of the military to be able to fight their cases and provide legal service, both with their cases and also with other issues as well. And he said that he wanted to tell his story. And within a matter of days, they had him, they contacted him. They said, well, we want you to go on the Rachel Maddow Show and tell your story to and tell the world that you're fighting your discharge. And in order to do that, he basically had to come out to his entire family before he actually went on national television and came out. But he chose to fight, and he was successful in fighting the discharge. And in September of 2010, just a few days before the – or a few days after, I can't remember which, before actually the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell was implemented, the policy was implemented, he actually had his 20th year anniversary celebration, retirement celebration. So he actually did retire as a 20-year veteran.
Rachel Maddow has been very accommodating to people in this situation. I know she's been very much involved for a long time with trying to shed light on this situation.
Rachel Maddow, I think, was one of the most significant people. There were a few, but I think Rachel Maddow was one of the most significant people that actually, day after day after day after day during the repeal movement before Don't Ask, Don't Tell was struck down. She was one of the primary people that actually brought these issues out to the public almost on a daily basis. And actually, you had mentioned before that in December of this year, 2015, will be the 5-year anniversary of the repeal of the law. And in September of 2016 will be the 5-year anniversary of the implementation of the repeal of the law in the military.
We have just 1 minute left. Let me end it by asking you what you hope to accomplish with this book.
I think what I hope to accomplish with this book is to reveal the stories of people whose lives are no different than everyone else's, who chose to serve, who chose to serve for many, many different reasons. And to be able to educate, to be able to I think even more importantly, to be able to give a voice to the people who had no voice, who had no identity while they were serving in the military.
Well, Vincent Chiani, we want to thank you for letting us hear some of those voices today. Congratulations on the book, and I'll give our audience a reminder that a special Gaze in the Military exhibit of Vincent's photos will be shown at Webster University's May Gallery from February 27th to March 27th, and he'll be having a talk at Webster this Friday, as I understand it, at 3. We'll have information on this on our website. Vincent, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Don.
Coming up, the new Missouri Commissioner of Education. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.